A week of political bombshells, two unexpected resignations, and the Supreme Court confronts the Prime Minister. Let's get started here on Question Period.
An historic decision in the Supreme Court, ruling against the Prime Minister's wishes. Opposition leader Tom Mulcair on that from Montreal. In Alberta, Alison Redford bows out.
I am resigning as Premier of Alberta, effective this Sunday evening.
Was she forced out, or was the pressure too much? And after the finance minister waved goodbye, a secretive mini-cabinet shuffle.
Can we get some comments from you behind the big SUV?
Joe Oliver becomes Canada's second most powerful politician.
It's so critical to maintain our economic strength.
His appointment is an embarrassment to Canada.
Is the new minister right for the job? Our press gallery on the new appointments. Plus, Stephen Harper announces new support for Ukraine.
We are here today to reiterate our commitment to your independence.
The latest from the troubled region.
The Prime Minister has a busy week of travel. He met Ukrainian leaders in Kiev yesterday, is in the Netherlands for the next few days, then heads to Munich and Berlin to meet with Chancellor Merkel on Wednesday. He'll be meeting with his G7 counterparts tomorrow, a last-minute meeting on the Ukrainian crisis. Joining me now from The Hague, CTV's Laurie Graham, who is traveling with the Prime Minister. So, Laurie, what can we expect when the G7 meets?
Well, Bob, we can expect not to see Russian President Vladimir Putin. Putin was part of the G8, but after everything that's happened in Ukraine, he was removed from tomorrow's meeting. So, it's G7 countries, Canada, the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Italy, and Japan. They called an emergency meeting for tomorrow to talk about Ukraine and Russia. Some leaders would like Putin exiled permanently, and Prime Minister Stephen Harper is one of them, Bob.
Well, I guess this also is going to play well back home, Laurie.
No doubt, Bob. For more than a million Canadians of Ukrainian heritage, to see their Prime Minister visit Independence Square and offer such a public show of support, to see Harper sit down with the Ukrainian Prime Minister in solidarity, that means a lot to people deeply affected by what's happening in Ukraine. And as the next federal election approaches, Conservatives can also hold this trip up to all Canadians, asking who they would rather see on the international stage taking on the likes of Putin. Stephen Harper or Justin Trudeau? So, Bob, this trip plays very well back home.
Laurie, Harper heads to Germany later this week to meet with Chancellor Merkel. What can we expect from those meetings?
Well, another important meeting for Harper, Bob. Trade is on the agenda, but let's face it, of the G7 leaders, Merkel is the one closest to Putin, the one who has his ear. And even though Harper will see Merkel at the G7, it's a short meeting. So Harper will have the chance when he heads to Germany to talk to Merkel one-on-one, an opportunity for Harper to make his views clear, but maybe even apply a little more pressure.
Thanks so much, Laurie. Appreciate it. As Laurie mentioned, with a federal election a year away and more than 1 million Canadians of Ukrainian origin, Stephen Harper's trip to Ukraine yesterday makes him look good at home and abroad, being the first G7 leader to visit Kyiv since the ouster of the pro-Russian regime. CTV's Danielle Hamadjian is in Kyiv, and she joins me now. Danielle, what was the takeaway from the Prime Minister's brief stopover there?
Hi, Bob. Well, Stephen Harper talked about the 1994 Budapest Memorandum signed by a number of countries, including Russia, which guaranteed Ukraine's territorial integrity so long as it gave up its nuclear weapons, which it did. And Harper says Russia is violating that agreement and in doing so is sending a dangerous message to other players out there, making negotiations with those key players very difficult. Let's hear from Stephen Harper and then from Arseniy Yatsenyuk, who basically spelled it out.
President Putin has provided a rationale for those elsewhere who needed little more encouragement than that already furnished by pride or grievance to arm themselves to the teeth.
It would be very difficult to convince anyone in the world, starting with Iran and then with North Korea, to give up its nuclear weapon.
Danielle, Harper arrived in Kyiv with the Canadian flag that flew over Parliament Hill during the crisis. He presented it to Mr. Yatsenyuk, but what else did he bring, if anything?
Well, he pledged continued support for Ukraine, but it's easy to get the feeling he's here just as much to show antipathy for the Russian government. Now, remember a few days ago, German Chancellor Angela Merkel effectively declared the G8's dead as long as Putin doesn't reverse course. Well, today, Stephen Harper, who we know has called the G8 the G7 plus one, was asked if he would like to see Russia booted out of the G8. Well, he didn't give a straight answer, but he did say that it doesn't take much imagination to figure out what his answer would be. There you have it. And Yarsin Yatsenyuk later said, listen, if there's going to be an empty seat at the table, Ukraine will take it.
Well, we saw an escalation in sanctions this week by Canada, by the U.S., and by the European Union. Is Ukraine satisfied? You had a one-on-one with Mr. Yatsenyuk. What did he say?
Well, he said that what we've seen so far, which are mostly financial sanctions against individuals, is not going to make Vladimir Putin reverse course here. Yes, Canada and the U.S. have gone after one specific bank, and he's very happy about that. But remember, Canada and the U.S. don't have the same commercial interests at stake here. There is a lot of division within the EU as to how to punish Russia. But in terms of the travel bans and asset freezes that the Europeans have imposed, he's not at all impressed by that. Listen to what he had to say.
The key problem is that a number of countries have no real desire to impose tough economic sanctions, as everything's so interlinked in this global world that no one wants to pay the price for freedom.
And Bob, I asked him about asking the West for boots on the ground, and his answer, he will not ask what he knows he won't get.
Thanks so much, Danielle. Well, did the Prime Minister give a strong enough commitment to Ukrainians yesterday, or was it just electioneering optics? I'm joined now by Ukraine's ambassador to Canada, Vadim Prosenko. Ambassador, thank you for joining me. First, I want to get an update, if I can. We saw yesterday the Russian troops took over the last, Ukrainian military base in Crimea. One soldier was injured. Do we know if there are any other incidents of this happening in Crimea or other demonstrations that are pro-Russian in eastern Ukraine?
You're right. We are still seeing these bases to be seized, and the Ukrainian ships of Navy, our Black Sea Navy, been blocked. At least the 30 of them already sort of seized as well. We have the commander of this base being detained, arrested. We have no clear information on this. And that's about the Crimea itself. In the rest of the Ukraine, we have the demonstrations pro and against the federalization or different ideas of how to get to what the Crimeans did. So we have in most of the southern and eastern cities, and the biggest one in Kyiv, in the capital of Ukraine.
So I want to ask you about the Prime Minister's visit. It was short, it was symbolic, but he didn't bring anything new. There was no new money. There were no doctors to help the injured people who were injured in the square many weeks ago. There were no offers of military advisors. There was no offer, which was really crucial to Ukrainians, is technical advice dealing with economic and monetary policy. So are you disappointed that, although it was an important visit, he didn't bring anything concrete?
You know, I can't agree to what you're saying, because there are things he brought himself. We have this UNESCO pledge for some significant money for OSCE mission. We will have up to 400 immediately the OSCE observers around Ukraine to show that what's really going on in Ukraine, to cancel, to take out this pretext that Ukraine now we have rampaging neo-Nazis to whatever the Russian TV is saying. The Prime Minister brought the ideas of how the Ukraine will go with the international help. We're talking about the technical assistance for a judiciary system, for the government capacity building. There are things, and there are, as you mentioned, the doctors who will be treating people who are still injured, needs some assistance, medical assistance, but it's done mostly by Ukrainian-Canadian community. It is supported by both governments, but the core of these efforts are Ukrainian community here in Canada.
So the Russians have at least bent a little in allowing observers from the Organization for Security and Economic Cooperation in. That seems to indicate that they are going to be satisfied with Crimea and won't be making any moves into eastern Ukraine.
Now, unfortunately, they did not extend as the representative to OSCE. You know, OSCE is 56 countries. As a representative to OSCE, they did not extend the mandate to the Crimea itself. because the initial idea was to show what's really going on in Ukraine, and Crimea is Ukraine as well. We are talking now about mission in the mainland Ukraine, which is also a good step, but we would like to expose what is really going on in Crimea as well.
But at least if you have observers there, it's an indication that they may not at least try to annex eastern Ukraine. Now, on terms of Crimea, the G7 leaders are meeting tomorrow in The Hague. I expect they're going to kick Putin out of the G8. What more can they do? And I guess I really mean, don't they need to put some sanctions in with some bite?
You know, after following the Canada's example, yesterday Japan announced another $1 billion of assistance to Ukraine. So it's not about the West, as we used to call it, it's East as well. The G7 is united. How to support Ukraine? European Union stepping in with the money, with advice, with an ideas. You know, on Friday we just signed the agreement, political part of the association agreement with the European Union. If you remember, the not signing the agreement actually sparked all the protests on the streets in November last year.
But if they there aren't the kind of tough sanctions that are going to really hurt. I mean, they've put some travel bans on. They've gone after some of the financial assets of some of the of Putin's buddies. But if you're going to hurt them, you've got to hit them with tougher sanctions. And certainly that would be more helpful to you. Otherwise, they're not going to leave Crimea.
You're right, and nobody wants it this year. You know, we are living 21st century. We are not prepared to fight with killing people on the streets, especially when we're talking about G7, sort of the club of leaders who are supposed to lead the world peacefully and wisely. And now we see the one of these members trying to resolve the issues or grab whatever they like, the territory of the neighbor, especially the, in our case, Ukraine and Russia, the two brother nations. I understand what you're saying, that some people would call for much tougher sanctions. At the same time, you could hear the voices that saying that, listen, we have to trade, we have to cooperate, we have to be partners around the globe, trying to bring them to senses, not to fight. Our response was that by this time, that very helpful for the help, assistance to us, and the pressure which has been exerted on Russia's side to let them understand that there is a limit of this sort of behavior, barbaric nowadays. If it can be stopped, if it can be reversed, that's the whole idea all of us we are trying to achieve.
Well, Ambassador, thanks for coming in this morning to speak to us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Opposition leader Thomas Mulcair on the Harper government's Supreme Court blow-up. And the winners and losers so far in the Quebec election campaign with our insiders coming up on Question Period. The Supreme Court gave a resounding thumbs down to Stephen Harper's appointment of Marc Nadon to sit on the High Court. What does it mean politically? Joining me now from Montreal, opposition leader Thomas Mulcair. Mr. Mulcair, this was a stinging rebuke to Stephen Harper. What do you make of it?
It's unprecedented, as you know, Bob, that the Supreme Court would reject an appointment by the government like that. And you know what? It's not only a rebuke of Stephen Harper's appointee. It's a rebuke of the Stephen Harper method. It's my way or the highway. Everyone had warned them that there were going to be problems with this nomination, and the judgment comes right in the middle of a provincial campaign where everything is very sensitive with regard to the federal role in Quebec affairs. This is an error. It's not only an error that affects the Supreme Court, it's an error that affects our democratic institutions. Stephen Harper should clarify one thing right away, that there's no question of him trying to come back with this appointee. If he clarifies that, then at least we're on the right track. He'll still have to explain why his minister, Peter McKay, was allowed to get into that sort of situation. There was no possible way to read that statute otherwise, and that's what the Supreme Court has just said.
Isn't this a way, what the Supreme Court has done, is being a victory for federalists by saying that, you know, Quebec has a right to have their own judges on the Supreme Court, and that it would mean that Pauline Marois could not have used this Supreme Court ruling against the federalist forces in Quebec during the election?
Fair enough. That is quite right. The silver lining in this whole debacle. But the problem is, of course, that we still have a Canadian government that failed to respect the basic constitutional right of Quebec to have three judges on the Supreme Court as defined in the statute. So while we do have the silver lining you just described, we have a Supreme Court that backs up Quebec's rights, which is a good thing. At the same time, everybody in Quebec is saying, but why doesn't Stephen Harper respect Quebec's rights?
Now, the High Court says the government can't unilaterally change the composition of the Supreme Court without the unanimous consent of Parliament and all the provinces. I would gather then that Harper's efforts to reform the Senate are probably also going to be struck down by the Supreme Court.
Well, he hasn't made too many efforts to reform the Senate, as you know. He's in his ninth year in power, and he talked a good game about Senate reform. It was one of the key themes of the Reform Party. But he also said that he would never appoint an unelected senator. He's gone on to name 59 of them. A lot of them are defeated candidates, and that's even more galling to have defeated candidates who have been rejected by voters making laws for the rest of Canadians. But, you know, there's probably going to be tracks laid down by the Supreme Court saying you can go this way. We've been concentrating on the why we should get rid of the Senate, and the Supreme Court will give us the how, and they'll tell us what type of amending formula is required.
Now, I want to ask you about this. The courts seem to be, the Supreme Court and other courts seem to be striking down Harper's law and order agenda. You saw the Supreme Court ruling the other day about Harper not wanting nonviolent people to be left out on early parole. We see minimum sentences. Judges say, no, we're not going to impose these minimum fees. The courts seem to be fighting back against this government.
Right, and they're fighting back using the rule of law. We do live in a society based on the rule of law, which essentially means that the law applies to everyone, including Stephen Harper. So you're not allowed to bring forward legislation that goes against people's fundamental rights as set down in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And so the courts have been doing that for just over 30 years with the Charter. But of course, as this government has rolled out more and more legislation that was essentially tainted with a view that was basically partisan. This was a play to their Reform Party base. We're the tough guys. We're the ones on law and order. We're going to do this, this, and that, and the other thing. More often than not, it didn't produce much of a result, but when it did, it often went against the guaranteed rights. So I guess Mr. Harper must view this as sort of a win-win. He gets to complain then about judge-made law and moan that it's just not fair. But it is a good thing, frankly, Bob, that we have the court standing up for all of our rights, because Stephen Harper's agenda, of course, has failed to respect our rights.
Well, let's go to the cabinet shuffle and the appointment of Joe Oliver as finance minister. Employment Minister Jason Kenney is calling on you to apologize for what he says were nasty, vicious, and extremely personal comments against Mr. Oliver.
Well, Mr. Oliver's comments are there for everyone to read, and the reaction to them is also on the public record. Mr. Oliver has made statements that personally attacked a key NASA scientist on global warming. He says that climate change doesn't exist. He's always denied that global warming was a reality. But more importantly, he went after First Nations in our country, saying that they were socially dysfunctional. And one of the chiefs who was the object of that invective had very harsh words for him. And yes, I remember repeating those words from that chief. That's the way he felt about it. And frankly, I thought that those remarks against Canadian First Nations were totally unbecoming anyone in government, and I was very surprised that the same person would therefore be named our finance minister. I don't think that that's a good appointment whatsoever.
So you're not going to apologize?
No, I'm going to continue to say that this is an unacceptable appointment.
All right, now let's talk about Trinity Spadina, the seat vacated by Olivia Chow. Justin Trudeau promised open nominations and then blacklisted the Liberal candidate, Christine Innes. That writing association has publicly rebuked their leader. You think this is going to give you guys an edge now in that writing?
Well, I believe we have an edge in that writing, and the edge is called years of incredible hard work by Olivia Chow. And we've always worn our middle name very well. We're the new Democratic Party. And I've already seen in the papers that there's a young man with, you know, great experience working with the Stephen Lewis Foundation, who's throwing his hat into the ring. We'll see who else, if at all, comes along. And guess what? They're going to be vetted as they have to be. That's part of the process. But I'm going to let the membership decide who our candidate is, and I'll throw my full support behind the person chosen by the members of the NDP. That's democracy in action, Bob. That's the way the NDP does things.
Well, let me ask you about this. Is your party abusing House of Commons funds by setting up satellite offices in Quebec and in Saskatchewan where you don't even have any MPs for political party activities?
No, our party employees do party work, and our parliamentary employees do caucus support. when we do set up with somebody in Saskatchewan, there are big issues there that I'll be traveling on. Issues like the inability of the Conservatives to deliver grain to market. That's affecting the whole country, whether it's the port in Vancouver or in Thunder Bay, and it's a key issue economically. The agricultural community is up in arms about Stephen Harper's failure to deliver the grain to market and after this bumper crop. So no, we're going to continue to do our political work across the country. And by the way, all this has been vetted since day one, when Jack Layton set it up 3 years ago, by the appropriate authorities within Parliament. And any suggestion that there's the slightest problem with any of this is frankly just wrong.
All right, Mr. Mulcair, thank you very much for coming in to speak to us.
Pleasure, Bob. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
There were no knockouts in the Quebec election debate on Thursday, but was there a clear winner? Joining me now are Quebec insider Jean Lapierre from Montreal, and here in the studio with me, André Béchamp. André, you were the Prime Minister's senior Quebec advisor. What would have possessed the Prime Minister to appoint Justice Marc Nadon to the Supreme Court when everybody said this guy really wasn't qualified for that, nor did he meet the qualifications for a Quebec judge?
Yeah, but it has nothing to do with personal. It's not personal vis-a-vis Monsieur Nadon. But you know what? As a Quebecois, it's one of the best decisions that the Supreme Court did. They respect Quebec. They respect the fact that we need to have three judges coming from the civil system, judicial system in Quebec. This is a great decision. And by the way, that will say a lot about the next decision regarding the Senate reform.
I agree with you, but why would Harper do this? Why would he appoint somebody like that? You were his Quebec advisor.
I'm sure that the Prime Minister, you know the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister received, you know, backgrounder memos and about the, but something was missing in the system is the spirit that goes with. And so when you look at the law, that's one thing, but the spirit of why the law was, you know, adopted, that was the missing link in this decision.
Well, Jean, looks like the Prime Minister is simply tone deaf to Quebec, but certainly the Quebec Federalists must be happy to have this victory, so Pauline Marois can't run around saying, look, the Supreme Court is against Quebec.
No, it's a great day for Canada. It's a great day for minority rights because, in a way, it's to protect a minority system, legal system. And, you know, frankly, the Prime Minister made a mistake, had a lack of judgment on this one. Now the Supreme Court threatened him out, and I think it's the good thing to do. And so, no, it's a great day for Quebec and for civil law. And as a member of the Quebec Bar Association, I can only applaud.
Okay, now let's go back to the TV debates, André. Philippe Couillard did very well in the debate, but he didn't do any knockouts. Is this enough, do you think, that he will continue to be in the lead?
Yeah, because there was a trend, so he was able to secure and comfort the trend. So he's you know, he did a good job yesterday. He was the new face for the debate. He did a good job, but again, he was not the winner, but he was not the loser, and he did act like a statesman. So you know what? We might have seen M. Couillard as being the next Premier of Quebec.
Well, let me ask you this, Jean. Pauline Marois tried to bury the boogeyman of separation in her speech in the TV debates on Thursday night. Did she succeed? And what are you picking up on the ground since the debates on Thursday?
Well, the first thing is Madame Marois is stuck with a ballot question. And 72% of Quebecers now think that if you vote for the PQ, you vote for a referendum. 64% of Quebecers don't want a referendum. So she is now trying to change the channel. She did not succeed because she kind of said, well, you know, no, we're not going to have a referendum unless Quebecers want it. But I mean, that means that she would use every means to try to change public opinion. And for the next 4 years, she would just work on trying to create the winning conditions for a referendum for a yes. So everybody read through that, so she could not bury the ballot question. That was her task that night, and she didn't succeed. Now, can that hold for 17 days to go? Obviously, there's another debate next week on our TVA network, and we shall see. But at this time, the fact that nobody really won the debate, well, it's the guy that has the momentum that wins, and that happens to be Philippe Couillard and the Liberals because they got the ballot question on a silver plate by Pierre-Carl Péladeau.
Now, let me ask you about Palladio. He's not talking about separation anymore. Now he's trying to talk about the economy. Is that going to work for them?
No way. No way. When he was, the first thing he did was this, and after that, as you know, he was pushed aside by Madame Marois. So there's no way for Pierre, Monsieur Palladio, to be credible for the rest of the campaign. Of course, they need to show him. He's a great businessman again, but he's not a politician. And you're going to see less and less of Monsieur Palladio. They're going to